Hello and welcome once again to Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. You are with me, Jason McKenna, talking to your local politicians. So, Bambos, today we start off with the heartbreak of the Three Lions. England lost in the Euro 2020 final. We were all so excited. But I wanted to ask you, where did you watch it? And were you still able to enjoy it, even if the result was not that great?
Well, I did enjoy watching it. I went and watched it around my brother's. So we were both like, we were just egging England on, like, sort of right from the outset. And, you know, we did feel that sitting back wasn't the solution, that they should have really gone out and attacked a bit more and got a second goal maybe. But, you know, it's hard in those circumstances, because if you score early and you can defend a lead, then one might well be enough. But no, it was I won't say it was enjoyable, because it was like really tense for about sort of over an hour. So yeah, it was quite a tense occasion. But England played brilliantly in that first half, absolutely amazing. And I think there's really good hope for the future. But yeah, just such a shame that they lost.
Yeah, it was very heartbreaking. I think there was a collective groan of sadness and disappointment across the country. But then what I would say as well is there was a groan of collective disappointment in a lot of fans and a lot of the conduct before, during and after the match. And a loss there was added to, and it was even more heartbreaking to see the hate, abuse, the disgusting racism that was piled upon a lot of the players. And so the fallout of this has brought many questions to the fore about social media, racism, and what can be done. One of the ideas that has been kind of put out there is, should people have to have IDs to be able to have social media accounts? Bambos, do you think that this is a good idea? And if not, what would be a useful idea to actually put in place?
I'm a bit torn by this, because I think that if you say something in public to somebody and it's causes offence, potentially it could be actionable. So why should you have that protection if you're saying it on a platform? Because if you're going to be offensive and abusive, then if you're going to be doing that in public, then why should you be able to get away with it by being on a social media platform? Now, some people say that, you know, there are people who are freedom fighters and who, you know, use platforms for the greater good and say things and whistleblowers, and that this is given into the state, and by allowing the state to access your or know who you are, then that prevents you from being able to you know, tell the truth about situations where you otherwise you might be oppressed. So I think it's about striking that balance. And so I do think that the social media companies need to do more. I think they need to be much better at taking down content. I think in the most serious of circumstances, if it's so extreme that the Crown Prosecution Service wants to press charges, I think there might well be a need to make sure that those people are brought to justice, and then people might learn a lesson about not having the abuse, not producing the abuse online, because it's quite disgusting, and it's so awful that there's this big pile on who three essentially brilliant, brave young men who did nothing but play football for their country and did so in a very expert way, and just happened to miss the penalties. And anyone can miss a penalty. I was once playing football when I was a student. We were in a penalty shootout, and after seven penalties, we won 2-1.
Oh, that is a lot of misses in there. I mean, that's almost the opposite to what happened to David De Gea at Manchester United, you know, with the 11 penalties going in. But with that situation, just kind of building upon it a little bit more, Bambos, I think one of the things when I discussed with Daisy Cooper, and which I will bring up when I speak to Bim Afalami as well, was that social media companies act very fast when copyright is kind of breached. You see somebody tweet out a picture of their favorite footballer or a video of them doing tricks or skills, and that's removed within minutes. Whereas a racist comment, a DM that is really abusive and may cause somebody harm is seen as almost a right of free speech. Do you think that the onus is on the social media companies to actually kind of doctor what is being said, but then does that tread into free speech issues itself of them policing what people are allowed to say?
Well, I think we don't have complete free speech. There's always a balance, and that balance has to be as to what causes offence. So I do think that, and there's a whole issue about whether they're publishers or not, because if you're a publisher, then you're also potentially liable to be sued for that. I think they are responsible. I think it is down to them to take down hateful content, especially if it's racist or offensive in its nature. They need to act quicker, as you rightly say. So I don't buy the argument that it's... I think they do need to act quicker. It is their responsibility, and if they don't do that, there should be consequences.
So moving to a local issue here, or maybe something that isn't an issue at all, it was actually a nice moment for you. This month you got to see Our Voices Choir perform a socially distant concert in Broomfield Park. What was probably most brilliant for you, though, is they sung the official Bambos Charalambos theme tune of Under Pressure. How was this experience, and was it nice to feel like things were returning a bit back to normal after COVID?
It was. I mean, it was a lovely setting. There were lots of friends and family of the choir there. I've seen them rehearse previously. They're a wonderful group, and I know they get a lot out of it. And it's just a wonderful way to enjoy a nice summer's evening. And it did have, I think I said it was my first live gig I'd been to, like probably in about 2 years. So it was a real joy to tell them. And yeah, music's always brings pleasure to me. I can't imagine life without music. And I think that having such a community-spirited choir singing so wonderfully was a real joy.
I mean, the big question for you, Bambos, is will you be joining the choir anytime soon?
Well, I probably failed the audition, but never say never. But I think I'd I probably wouldn't be able to make the relevant choir practices to get me up to speed.
That's a shame. I'm sure they will be missing the voice of Bambos during the theme tune of Under Pressure. Since we last spoke, though, you had celebrations on a local level as the North Middlesex University Hospital neonatal team won an NHS Parliamentary Award for their work with families and newborns during the COVID-19 pandemic. This was after your nomination. Was it special to be at the ceremony, but also to see their hard work recognised that you brought to attention?
Absolutely. I think there are so many... these are the parliamentary NHS awards sponsored by, I think, Dodds, and they were. It's such a lovely event because you can showcase the areas of good practice across the country, and I think that it's a good way of bringing everyone together. And I knew that they'd won the regional award, which meant they went through to the final, which was held last week and 2 weeks ago, and they were brilliant. It was such a joy to be able to share in their success. And I'm planning to go and visit them at some stage and see them physically and meet with them. And I've even said that when we're allowed to, I'm happy to have them come to Westminster and we'll have a drink on the terrace together.
I mean, it's kind of almost extending the clap for the NHS there, recognising the brilliant work of local pandemic workers there. It's fantastic to see. Let's move on to, though, the party, because Labour, since again we last spoke, there's been celebrations for the Labour Party's Kim Ledbetter had success in her by-election. Now, first of all, Bambos, you were there on the front line. What was campaigning in this constituency like as you were on that front line?
It was quite mixed. I went to a number of different areas. So Batley and Spend. Batley is it's like the centre of a wheel, and the villages are like spokes coming out from Batley. Some of the villages were they're very friendly, but in a very Yorkshire way. That, you know, I spoke to a gentleman who said I asked him how he was going to vote, and he said, "Well, that's private, but all I say is my daughter went to school with Kim, and I wouldn't be unhappy if she won." So it was a bit of that. So it was very pleasant in the villages. It was a bit tougher in the in Batley itself. There were a number of obviously George Galloway was there, and he had a big team out with him. So it was really persuading people on every doorstep, particularly members of the local minority communities. But I think the fact that Kim was such a strong local candidate, people had knew her, they'd been to school with her, they'd spoke to somebody who'd been to one of her gym classes. So it's so when you have that level of recognition, I think it was Kim that actually was the difference. I think her being a strong local candidate made a big difference there.
But focusing on the actual result there was only 393 votes between the Conservatives and Labour. But you did mention there that George Galloway was involved with it, and he did get 21.9% of the voter share. Do you think that with the situation there that voters were once again still unsure about Labour's core messages, or was it the George Galloway effect of having another left-wing party in the area?
I mean, I think George Galloway was is an opportunist, and I think he decided to see if he could sort of muddy the waters. He had an agenda. He had a very strange strategy in appealing to Muslim voters, but also trying to appeal to the anti-woke voters as well, which was a strange strategy. But I think ultimately people decided that the Labour Party was still their party that wanted to represent them. And I don't know who it was, but a famous politician said that, you know, winning by one vote's enough, the rest is vanity. So I think it's, but obviously want to be winning by a lot more. But clearly it's, I do think this is a turning point. And I do think that you will see the Labour Party back. There have been a number of changes made at the top, and I think you'll see us back to true form before too long.
I mean, do you want to open out what these changes are? What kind of things can voters expect from the Labour Party going forward?
I think part of it is getting our message across. So you've had Rachel Reeves, who's been very strong about our message about buying British. So I think that's one clear message that we're getting out there. I think also holding the government to account, about things like the sleaze and the contracts, and also about the way the government are mishandling COVID. So, you know, we'll have heard recently that some of the Balearic Islands are now back on the amber list, having been on the green list for 2 weeks, and it's playing havoc with people's plans. And I think just the way that, you know, you're now seeing restrictions are being relaxed just as we're entering an exponential spike in infections. I think people are beginning to see that, you know, the mask is slipping off the government, that they are not fully in control of the situation. And so it doesn't fill people with enthusiasm. So I think a combination of the party getting sacked together and the exposing the Tories to their failings will make a big difference.
One of the criticisms of Labour has been, ironically, that they were not critical enough of the government during this COVID crisis. With it becoming a little bit more normal now, will it be business as usual? Will there be more statements in criticism of the government going forward?
I think there will be more statements, because I think initially people did want to have a degree of national unity in dealing with the pandemic. But but the pandemic first hit over 18 months ago. So it's we're past the stage now whereby the government the government have had more than enough chance to try and deal with the pandemic, and this is just incompetence now if they're not handling it as they should do. So I think now there's no excuse for them to be messing up.
Moving it on to local issues, where you have been very critical, you've been outspoken, you've been vocal on this issue. You've kept the pressure on the opening of Merca slots, but it does seem that the opening of the establishment is going ahead. You've stated that the fight continues, but Bambos, how can it so?
Well, I think once the license has been granted, then you can review the license if the in this case Merca slots are in breach of it at all. So we need to see what the conditions are of the license, and if they breach it, we can ask for a review that can effectively close them down. So they better be on their best behaviour. But also, there's been a review about the gambling legislation. I've fed into that review by the government, and I'll be interested to see what comes out from the government, because I think the way that there's this presumption in favour of gaming companies and making gambling, that presumption being in favour of gambling, I think it needs to be looked at again. And I think people need to have a proper say, which I don't think we had this time.
And so finally, let's move on to what you've been doing in the House of Commons there. And since we last spoke, you cast recognition onto World Refugee Day, but you also gave the closing speech in Westminster Hall on Wednesday about delays in the asylum system. You stated it is clear that the asylum system is broken. Bambos, what needs to be done to fix it?
Well, a number of things. It seems crazy that we're having fewer applications and yet they're taking, and we've got more staff, but it's taking longer to process them. So I do think we need to have certainly more investment, more staff to deal with the applications. I have a constituent who was waiting for 7 years for his application to be processed. 7 years is an awful long time. But he's not alone. There are tens of thousands of people whose lives are on hold because of the delays in processing the applications. So what I want done is there to be more staff employed to actually process the applications. But I think there should also be a standard whereby if a case isn't processed within 6 months, there has to be a review, because otherwise these cases are left to language, and we're talking about people's lives. People cannot get on with their lives while the claim is stuck in limbo. So I think that's what needs to be done there.
There is also talk from a lot of groups, individuals, that the government is going to be introducing laws that would actually contravene human rights laws that the government has signed up to historically. How can Labour make sure that this does not happen?
Well, the government have an inbuilt majority, but I'm concerned that in the Nationality and Borders Bill, which is coming our way on Monday and Tuesday of next week, you will have the government have decided to interpret some international law in a very strange way. So international law says you shouldn't punish people because they're refugees. And yet there are a number of punitive measures in the bill. And also they've chosen to interpret the Refugee Convention in a strange way, which I'm sure would be subject to legal challenge. So I just have concerns that the government are behaving in a way that is designed purely to grab the headlines, but not behaving in a way that wouldn't stand up to proper public scrutiny. So I'll be challenging the government on this, as with my colleagues, and trying to hold them to account. But ultimately, they do have a majority of 80, and they probably will be able to get this through. But that won't be the end of it, because I think it will be subject to legal challenge.
On that issue as well, a lot of kind of charities and individuals that look after refugees or people in crisis when they make the dangerous journey to the country. The Royal National Lifeboat Association has talked about how, because of this new legislation, their workers may be imprisoned because they are aiding a refugee in a situation. And private ship owners as well have talked about the fact that they might have to leave people to die. I mean, in terms of the protection, should be first and foremost to the refugees, but also to these private individuals who are doing the right thing. I mean, Bambos, can you give any assurances that that won't be included in the legislation?
Well, it's one of the clauses in the bill. So what they're saying is that anybody who aids, even if it's not for profit, somebody to reach the UK via an illegal route, could also be charged with that offence. So I think that's an appalling clause, and it will, and I think it actually breaches maritime law. So I'm interested in seeing how we can hold the government to account. We're going to have some evidence sessions before the bill goes to committee, and I'm keen to hear from people who are in that situation, people that do have boats who are likely to, you know, potentially be picking up and rescuing people who might get into difficulties in crossing the channel, and also the RNLI, just to see what they have to say about it. But I think that I can't believe that anyone would be punished for rescuing somebody who's drowning. I think that's totally wrong. And if that's the government's attitude, then they're certainly on the wrong side of that argument.
But in its current reading and its current form, it is not overplaying it to say that that is the current law that may be introduced.
Yeah, because the way it's worded, it's anybody who aids somebody, even if it's not for profit, to come to the UK illegally, could be prosecuted.
So let's move it on to the discussions from the local community, Bambos. As always, with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here for the community, and we always ask for questions for you. So let's move it to what the people of our local area want to know. Ian has sent in a message. He said, I actually messaged in June about taking the knee in football matches. Bambos, do you believe that the actions of fans at the final and the fallout since prove that taking the knee is the right thing to do?
Well, I would say that as long as racism is there, then certainly players should take the knee. I'm certainly keen to join my colleagues in Parliament taking the knee to show solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, but also with the against racism wherever it might be. Racism's been around for ages and ages. I remember as a very young Chelsea fan when I was still at school, I wrote a letter to Ken Bates, who was then the chairman of Chelsea Football Club, to protest about the National Front selling the newspaper outside the ground, but also about the racism inside the ground. Because, you'd hear some fans making monkey chants at some of the players, and that was absolutely disgusting and appalling. So it's been around a long time. I think things are changing. It is a minority, but it's still, as long as it's there, it still needs to be challenged.
Bambos, adding to this discussion, the very publicised Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities came to the conclusion that Britain was not a racist country and had no barriers to people of certain backgrounds. Do you think that the evidence from just even this incident alone shows that this was an incorrect conclusion?
I don't think this one incident would show it was an incorrect conclusion, but I think it was incorrect because of other issues as well. So you'd have seen that the structural racism that exists has led to many more people dying from COVID than from a minority ethnic background. So I do think that there are issues there that need to be addressed. Just the things like the overrepresentation of the Black and minority ethnic community in our prisons, for instance, and criminal justice is also part of the structural racism that we experience. So I do think that whereas in some places things may have improved, racism still exists and is still rife in our society, and we need to do what we can to challenge it. And so I disagree with the findings of the SAW report, but and I think we'll just leave it there, because you know, people will make their own minds up about what the SAW report actually said and its accuracy.
Amy has brought the discussion on to schooling, and she's talking about Sir Kevin Collins actually quit the government after recommending $15 billion to help schools recover, but only $1 billion was actually offered. How can, so this is Amy's words, how can they get away with letting our children down, but then wasting money on weapons or dodgy contracts? She said to you, Bambos, please hold them to account, Labour.
I totally agree with Amy. It's absolutely appalling that particularly in relation to catch-up funding, that the government won't fund it fully. The time that you lose as a child is very hard to make up. So I do think that the government needs to put more money into allowing kids to catch up. So the 1.4 billion is nowhere near enough, and it's not what Sir Kevin Collins recommended. So the government should totally fund that completely to what it was recommended, to the 15 billion. They've been wasting so much money on contracts that have been given out, not under the regular routes, but under the cover of COVID, to mates and pals and people that have got connections into government. So it's a real chumocracy when that happens. We have been trying to keep them to account. We have been, Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner and Keir Starmer have been holding account to the dispatch box. My colleagues and I have spoken out about this as well. It's just not good enough. I think there'll be an inquiry, and I think the inquiry will find out that these contracts have been handed out via various dodgy means. The Good Law Project had they won a judgment against Michael Gove for the giving out of a contract to somebody who was connected to Dominic Cummings. So there's and I think there's more legal challenge on the way. So let's watch this space. But we are doing what we can to challenge the government. I think it is making some of the Tories feel very uncomfortable, but hopefully there'll be some comfortable. They'll vote with us when challenging some of these decisions.
But what is the likelihood that people will be held to account? Because we hear quite often in the news discussions about, for example, Priti Patel broke the ministerial code, broke rules, but nothing seems to have happened. And I think maybe this is what Amy is kind of getting at, is there a way to hold them to account, Bambos?
Well, we can scrutinise them in Parliament, and if they've done things wrong, there are certain measures that can be taken. But the in relation to the ministerial code, I mean, in the past it would have been unheard of for people not to resign for breaching the ministerial code. And yet we've got, it's kind of like a runaway government, whereby they they're ignoring the rules that have happened in the past. So it's and this is not how democracy should function. You know, people need to play by the rules; otherwise, they should face the consequences. So I think that I think there will be, particularly with public contracts, there is. Where there's been shown to be some irregular activity and possible corruption in some cases, we don't know, that is a criminal offence. So I think that there should be the prospect of being able to push to make sure that legal action is taken, or that things are reported to the to the Commissioner for Parliamentary Standards. So there are avenues that are available that are not just about sort of votes in Parliament. But we need to look at the finer detail and make sure that those avenues are followed.
Nick has turned his attention to what he feels is a big local issue. He has explained, "I'm annoyed at the excuses the Enfield Council keep making over the failure to properly service our bins. The area is getting more dirty and we're told it's our fault, even though it is the council who has cut services year on year. Why can't we have our normal service back?" Bambos, what is the answer to this question then?
Well, two things. First of all councils have had to make cuts and have gone to, I'm not aware of any councils that still have weekly collections. I wish we did have weekly collections. And I know that's been problematic with lockdown because people are at home more with COVID, so they're producing more waste. And sometimes that waste isn't enough for their bins. And that's led to more people fly tipping. And that's made the whole place look unsightly. So I've raised these issues with the council. The council have promised to, where there is an issue with fly tipping, that they will clean it within 24 hours. They'll clear it within 24 hours. In relation to missed collections, there's really no excuse for missed collections. So if that happens, they should report it to the council. And if it's persistent, I'm happy to follow it up for Nick. The problem is that the all councils have had their budgets cut by a huge margin, in some cases more than 50% since 2010. And if you try living on half your income, you soon notice that you'd have to make some cuts here and there. So I think that's been the problem that not just Enfield but councils all around London and the country have had to face. And you've seen some councils go bust. So Croydon had they went bust and they had to get a bailout from the government. And also Bexley have had to have handouts, Northampton had problems as well. So it's not just an Enfield thing, it's happening across the board. And I will certainly be lobbying the government and have done to get more funding for Enfield.
Do you think that sometimes the problem is the legislation around what you can and can't put in your bins though? Because quite often when you go to the local dump or to kind of drop off an object which you think was fairly innocuous, you are then told that you can't give it to the dump, you know, certain types of paint or solvents or things like that, and you're told that you have to properly dispose of it. But if the council can't take care of it, then where do people actually have the ability to go to?
That is a good point. I think we need to make sure that, I mean clearly that the places like Carthatch Lane, which is the, sorry, not Barrowell Green. Barrowell Green does have areas where you can recycle things, but we also have places where you can just dump some of your household waste. And I think we should be focusing more on recycling. So I try and separate my waste, and if I go to Barrowell Green, I always make sure that, you know, the cardboard goes in one box and the wood goes in another and so on. So I think that's what we should be doing. We need to be recycling more and making sure that we produce as little waste as possible. Some things are not possible to recycle, unfortunately, and those will have to go into the waste. So I think we need to put pressure on the companies who make these products to see how best they can be recycled or else collected. So I think that's the challenge, but it's not necessarily the council's fault, although the council has the contract to take the waste away. But unfortunately, if it does that, it just will end up in an incinerator or in landfill.
Michelle has continued with the discussion about council decisions. She has asked, "I've seen the Enfield Council has announced that it wants to bring some new public spaces for the town, but we already have lots of spaces and it is a further cost to the council at a time when they are telling us to cut back elsewhere."
Well, I think with lockdown, people have enjoyed the outdoor more. So I think being outdoors is definitely something that we should be encouraging people to enjoy more. So I'm not against having more public spaces, because I think that that would bring together more communities. I think when people are stuck at home, just with their family or on their own, I think they do need to venture out and be able to enjoy things. And if public spaces make that happen, then I'm all for that. The cost of the council, again, I mean, there are two aspects of cost. There's the there's a capital cost, and that might be for just one-off buying equipment or sorting out some furniture. And then there's like the ongoing revenue cost, which is a cost that you pay year on year. So I think if this is a one-off cost, then I'd be quite relaxed about that. And I think it's something that maybe the council can recoup from developers who put in planning applications. There might be some funds available for this already, but, and it may not be part of the council's week-to-week budget.
So this would be a different account from maybe Nick, who is worried about the council picking up rubbish. This would not be involved in that. So it would be a capital, and as you said, they're two different accounts.
That's how I'd perceive that. But again, I'd need to look at the detail, but that's what I imagine has happened here.
Tina has asked a very important question here about fire safety and Grenfell. She's explaining that more than 900 London buildings are on the fire safety list, but she wants to know how many of these are in Enfield and what can residents do to keep safe?
Well, I don't have any in Enfield Southgate, but and I don't know how many there might be in Edmonton and Enfield North, who do have more of a propensity for tower blocks to be located there. I think that's, and clearly there are a number of issues about keeping the property safe. There's actually a fire safety bill going through Parliament next week. So it's so I think that's, I think it's actually a housing safety bill that's going through. So I think that would actually seek to address some of these issues. But clearly there's issues around anyone who lives on the top floor of a block knows that there's always issues with water pressure if you live that high up, because the water has to travel that distance to get to you. Some people recommended sprinklers, although that's not necessarily a solution in every case. But I think for some cases, sprinklers are a potential. But I think ultimately, if we're talking about cladding, then cladding needs to be addressed, and also who pays for the removal of the cladding. And the government have failed to address that. And I think unless they do that, then people will live in unsafe conditions, and they may not be able to sell them, which means they can't get on with their lives. And that's the challenge. So what I would say is, we need to make sure that the properties are properly inspected, and that the government are forced to remove the cladding as soon as possible, and that it's at no cost to the leaseholders, the owners maybe should pay for it, but certainly not the leaseholders.
Now, Tristan, I don't know if they are a time traveller, because they'd asked the question, what would you do if you were Prime Minister for one day and you could pass any law and introduce it immediately? I don't know if he knows that you're becoming Prime Minister anytime soon, Bambos. I don't know if you'd even want to be Prime Minister, because it's quite a stressful job. But along those lines there, Tristan has asked, what law would you introduce?
Oh, what a question. I think if I could pass one law, then I think if everyone could read, if everyone had the ability to read, I think if you're able to read, then that opens the door to so many things. And there's still, unfortunately, very high levels of illiteracy. And so I would, I'd have some sort of bill that everyone would be able to read, and it would, and investing in helping people to reach that level. Because once you're able to read, you can, it can open the gateway to everything. So that would be what I would do. I know it's not a very sexy sort of thing, but I do think it will be life-changing for so many people. And my my maternal grandmother was illiterate, so I know the problems that she had. So that, yeah, that would be what I would do.
And on that topic of being Prime Minister, would you ever want that role one day?
No, absolutely not. So I just seeing the grief that both, well, the two prime ministers I've seen close up have been Theresa May and Boris Johnson, but even the leaders of the opposition have had so much grief. So I think I'll leave that to other people to deal with.
There's
But I wish them well.
often the saying though that the person who wants the role least is probably the most suited for it because they would act in the interest of the country rather than themselves. In terms of that then, what would you say is your maximum aspiration, Bambos? I mean, you're currently in a shadow role. Is that probably as far as you'd like it? Obviously in terms of being on the front bench if you're in government as well.
I'm just happy doing what I'm doing, and if anything comes up, then if I get asked, I'll do whatever I'm asked to do. But it was it was unexpected for me to get elected as a Member of Parliament, and it's a real privilege and a joy to be serving the people of Enfield Southgate, and that's more than enough for me. But if I'm asked to serve and do any other role, then I'm happy to do that, and I'll leave it for others to decide if I'm sufficiently qualified or suitable to do those roles. But yeah, I'm pretty happy doing what I'm doing at the moment.
Apart from Prime Minister Bambos, we won't see Prime
Definitely
Minister
not.
Sharalambos one day. Karen has asked, I have a staycation coming up and love listening to political podcasts. I hope that one of those is this one here, Karen. But going forward, she's asked, she loves political podcasts and reading books about it too. Do you have any recommendations, Bambos?
Well, on the podcast, I tend to listen to The New Statesman, but also the Spectator's Coffee House Shots, just to find out what the opposition are up to. But for books, I've been quite big into audiobooks. The one I'm listening to at the moment is David Lammy's book called Tribes, which is very interesting, actually. It's an interesting perspective as to, why people are angry and about sort of the way it's looking at sort of the way we are now. But other things that I've read, obviously linked to my brief, I've read The Windrush Betrayal by Amelia Gentleman, which talks about the whole Windrush scandal, and Natives by Akala, the rapper. So that's a really good book. It's about 5 or 6 years old. I do like a bit of fiction as well. So there's I did read I listened in audiobooks. Maggie O'Farrell, she wrote a book called Hamnet, which is about Shakespeare's son Hamnet, which who he then his death affected his affected him, and he wrote his most successful play, Hamlet, as a result of that. So it just tells you the story seen through the eyes of different people. I probably have to read Jess Phillips' book, which is Everything You Need to Know About Politics, as Jess Phillips is also in the Shadow Home Office team. So I think I'll probably have to read that as well. But yeah, those are just some of the things that I would have a read of.
I mean, seeing that we're talking about future aspirations, will there ever be a Bambos
I don't know how they get time to write books.
Charalambos
I mean, maybe, yeah. I don't know what I'd write it about, but yeah, I'd be up for that. But there's so many MPs that are writing books, and I'm like, you guys must have, so much free time. But
Well, this is what the next question from Susan, the last question as well. She asked, you always seem so busy and proactive. This was a question that she put to all the MPs that appear on Radio Verulam. And she asked, when do you have time to see your family and spend time with them?
I try and visit my parents once a week, so it's usually pop around and see them on a Sunday. And other than that, I just try and fit the rest of the clan in whenever I get a chance to. But yeah, it's probably just Sunday to visit my parents is the one that I try and stick to, because otherwise I think they miss not seeing myself and my brother and sister and the nephews and nieces and stuff. So I think that's the one time I probably would set aside to see them.
Do you visit as well for some good food? I mean, that's always one of the reasons to go to the parents.
Yeah. Oh yeah, my mum's a very good cook, so yeah, it's always nice to be fed when you visit your parents. So yeah, that's rather than the sort of slapdash things that I knock up. Yeah.
Oh well, a useful insight into the life of a member of parliament there, as stated. We'll be hearing from Bim Afolami and Daisy Cooper on this question as well, because I think it's such a good one to kind of understand how, well, our politicians have to divvy up their time. But as always, Bambos, thank you for your time today. It was great to talk to you and get those answers for the community there. And we look forward to chatting to you again next month.
Thank you, Jason.